listener. Hi, and welcome back to Broadsheet Around Town. I'm Emma Joyce, features editor, and today's guest is someone I've admired for a really long time. He was born in Townsville, and he spends most of his time at his home and studio in Brisbane. Tony Albert is one of Australia's prominent contemporary artists. He's an avid collector of objects, particularly ones depicting Aboriginal people. And it's this collection of Aboriginalia that underpins a lot of themes in his artwork. He plays with dark humour, and he's deeply thoughtful about socio-political ideas. Tony has created large-scale artworks such as four giant bullets and three bullet shells that sit in Sydney's Hyde Park, as well as decorating the seats at places like Sydney's Allianz Stadium. But my favourite works by the Kuku Yolanji artist are those that made us feel a deep sense of shame around our shared history. But they're also super optimistic. They rewrite historical mistruths and injustice. And we'll talk about some of those artworks today, such as his Australia series, which is on display in Melbourne as part of Photo 2024. We'll also hear about Albert's important role in the Biennale of Sydney as its First Nations curatorial fellow. Plus, we'll get an insight into his daily life, what he likes to eat with the family, and a little bit about that endless optimism for the future. I'd like to start with Miley Cyrus. Okay. I think that you can explain why, but in 2020, you had an exhibition called You Wreck Me that played with the imagery of the Wrecking Ball video. You've now expanded on that visual. Talk us through that beaded work, its history, and what it represents.
Wow. Absolutely. So if I can take you back to that time in 2020, the first year, lockdown in the pandemic, and everyone's thinking, what's happening? What are we doing in the art world? A lot of Zoom meetings, which were becoming new to us. And at that point, the Institute of Modern Art in Brisbane, where I was in lockdown, contacted me and said, look, we'd love to help and support artists through this time by giving small opportunities that might be online or shown on screen. And if that's something that would interest you. And for quite a long time, actually, I'd been thinking of this idea of the way in which our communities are adorned within these statues, what they mean, who they represent, and quite often the problematic nature, the way these are presented. And I'd always had this idea after seeing the Miley Cyrus Wrecking Ball film clip, which was so iconic, of utilizing that as a form, very tongue-in-cheek, undertones of very dark humor, of actually knocking down these kind of colonial statues of who is perceived to be heroes or the white male hierarchy that exist within our colonial references. For me, being able to do that, one very lo-fi, one at home in front of a green screen, sitting on a exercise ball that I'd strung to the ceiling. it was just a lot of fun, actually, but had, like my work, those political undertones, which are very important and meaningful, but became this kind of catalyst for a much bigger idea that we launched on YouTube and was accessible for everyone and was fun during the period of global kind of conversations about this. And little beknown to me, the day we released the video, the first international statue was literally pulled down by community. So I had a lot of people calling me saying, how did you do this so fast? And it was just this symbiotic way in which communities respond to different things happening. So that's where that all started.
So you're seated on this exercise ball. What are you wearing?
Literally wearing ceremonial paint design on my body and a red lap, which is Indigenous term for a small covering, your private areas, legs around the kind of makeshift rope chain that I had and swinging from side to side on the exercise ball. So it is a really visually strong image of Aboriginal takeover or alluding to where that power sits. And if we need to knock these down, who should that be and why? Particularly when looking at, a lot of these statues in terms of the instigators of incredible violence against First Nations people.
it does a really good job of encapsulating a lot of things that you explore in your art. You have a dark humor, which you've talked about as being an optimism, really. And of course, a lot of these conversations that are purposefully political in the sense that we need to interrogate who we're holding up to as being those heroes. I'm doing these quote signs, and why we have these statues and who gets to be identified in a public realm in that way. And as you say, it was at a time globally that communities all over the world were doing the same thing, looking at who those statues are in those public spaces and taking their own action, which was an exciting time, I want to say.
Well, we certainly have to understand who's the victor within this and what history or what perspective of history do they want written, do they want seen, and do they want understood.
So you've revisited this very, very recently, and now we have this kind of beaded work. Can you describe those beads for us?
Well, attached to my latest show at Sullivan & Strumpf in Sydney, I've used what is considered the preview room within the gallery space. And it's almost an opportunity to show smaller study works or something which gives people a little more insight into probably the main show. And for this, for me, 20 years on in my practice, I spoke to the gallery directors and said, look, what really interests me is using the preview room as a platform and a platform for raising profiles of younger First Nations artists in a situation I was in 20 years ago and would have loved a little bit extra exposure or the potential to show my work in a place like Sydney.
Yeah, so you've chosen three underrepresented artists.
Underrepresented and underrepresented, is a very good term. Erica Morita from Far North Queensland, Kimon Williams from Brisbane, and Aidan Hartshaw from Canberra. So utilising that platform, I also wanted to make sure that the artists wouldn't be out of pocket or, that this would come at no expense to them. And in unravelling flights and accommodation and per diem, and I was just starting to realise, oh my God, this is an epic kind of philanthropic venture for me. And that's where the beading came out of. I was sitting at night watching the tennis over summer, doing these You Wreck Me beads with the opportunity or hope that I could sell them during the show as a little keepsake for people, but that would be the money to raise to have the artist travel and be there. So it was philanthropic. It was a chance for community to be involved, get something very accessible. They were $20 to $50 each. But it, really helped in making sure that these, artists could, fully realize the opportunity and be very engaged with that week without having to worry about any kind of financial issues.
And did you completely cover those costs?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. And if it didn't sell regardless, it was always going to be, that this was an opportunity I wanted to engage with. And I put my kind of money where my mouth is. And I was really grateful that the gallery, was also as keen and interested to the point where they also didn't take a commission on those younger artists' work either, that they were able to make lots of sales in their own right. And all that money went to those younger artists as well.
Do you consider yourself a morning or nighttime person, thinking about you beading while you're watching the tennis, for example?
I wouldn't consider all of them. I'm a person who just works constantly. So if I am sitting watching TV or having quiet time or something, my hands are always actively doing something because I don't like to waste time at all. A younger Tony would have been absolutely nighttime because I worked and lived in Queensland where the heat just can become intolerable during the day. And as an artist, often using makeshift studio spaces, which often aren't climate controlled in the best way, nighttime, really made that possible. But, as I've grown and become having more opportunities within the art world on chairs and boards and my own advocacy work, my life now tends to be much more driven by a daily schedule.
You are a wanted man in the best kind of way, which is that you really are participating in so many art events and festivals, as well as creating your own work and providing a platform for others. I'm surprised there's any time in your day, really. I would love to know a little bit about your special role in this year's Biennale of Sydney, because you're its First Nations curatorial fellow. What Yes. does that mean?
It's an opportunity I'm incredibly grateful for, and I came to the position with the knowledge and understanding that this is an incredible opportunity for us as people, for First Nations artists, for Aboriginal curators. But the Fondation Cartier in Paris had done a show with Sally Gabori, a really incredible Mornington Island artist who's passed away now, but her works are so stunning. And they've been around for 40 years, the Fondation Cartier, doing incredible projects. Actually, they've worked with the Yanomami people in Brazil, the Brazilian rainforest, for a very long time. So their knowledge and understanding of working with Indigenous people was there, but they never actually engaged with Australia in such a way. So they, through the Biennale of Sydney, have commissioned 14 global Indigenous artists to work, perform, be in residence during this time, which I have to say, in all my years of being involved, whether it be as an artist or an advocate or a practitioner curatorially, I've really never come across a commitment so huge. And at this point in time within the arts, we are really relying on big companies like that for these kind of opportunities philanthropically. And it was, for me, it was not just about being the inaugural curatorial fellow. It was laying the foundation for what I hope to be a continuing and ongoing successful relationship, which supports, you know, massive projects, or artists to conceive of massive projects to be included in this international Biennale, such as the Biennale of Sydney, and what the after effects of me being in that role can do. So I'm very well aware, I feel almost like a bit of an imposter saying that I'm a curator, but for me, it's taking these 20 years of work. And I say this not lightly, because I've seen opportunities like this come and go because they weren't started right. And my role is to start this right and know that any point in the future, I can reinsert myself in as an advocate, as an ally, and sort things out if they need to, but have the trust and confidence within a company like Fondation Cartier that Indigenous autonomy, the opportunity for us to be there, to be in the office, to engage with our own people and global Indigenous artists, is a methodology and way of thinking that is important and needs to be embedded within these institutions.
This role continues until 2027. So what would you like that legacy to be? Because you are that person building those really important foundations for the Yep. future of this event.
In all the things I've been to globally, what I see is Aboriginal Australia as seen as leaders within this platform. We have a tumultuous history, but we have fought really hard for that visibility, and our protocols and the cultural nuances that are attached to our institutions because of what we've fought for. And I'm talking Aboriginal advisory groups, welcomes and acknowledgement of country, changing Aboriginal spaces that now don't exist in the bottom corner of a gallery, but the first and foremost thing you see when you walk into an institution, Aboriginal art not even being dedicated to an individual space, but across the whole platform of galleries and global conversations. Why should Aboriginal art sit within the context of international art, within Australian art? What those conversations between artworks are happening, and the unique position we are within having the oldest living, surviving culture in the world, you know, that's our asset. That is what makes us who we are and what makes us so special, and why this hasn't been such a strong part of the vernacular for such a long time is you know, the core, I think, of my being, this wanting to change that story and provide, you know, this incredible platform for works to be seen. I always, in a sad way, climate is one of these issues which has really brought Indigenous conversation to the the forefront for a lot of people. You know, we are the first, you know, the last involved in climate change, but to the first, given our regional and remote communities to feel its devastating effect. And what people know and understand is this land has been managed and maintained for hundreds of thousands of years. And we need to change our way of thinking. We need, as a people, to become closer to the land that we're standing on. And these are all messages that come through so poetically, so meaningfully within Aboriginal artwork. So it's Aboriginal artwork. So it's a really great format to be having, you know, these kind of meaningful conversations.
If there's anyone listening who was like, wait, the Biennale of Sydney's on? Yes, it starts from March 9th and runs until June 10th. And it's called 10,000 Suns. Can you tell us a little bit about that title? Because I know from conversations that it's so multifaceted. There are lots and lots of different ways that we're talking about what sun might mean and its radiance.
Yeah, it's a really interesting title because it does challenge us in so many ways. And it's taken me a while to get my head around. And now when I think about the idea of 10,000 suns, I think of my journey. I think of your journey and the journey of all those artists. We all bring our own ideas to what the sun means in its cultural significance. And when I say cultural significance, just how we elevate and radiate, as you said, as people. There is 10,000, there is 100,000, there is 10 billion suns, really. But the reality of that situation is we do all exist under the same sun. So it's like this idea, equality exists through the acceptance of difference. We all bring those different suns to us when we gravitate and pull together and we share those stories of our suns that are all different and all unique in their own way. But then once we really think about it, it's all the same sun. We all share that. So that gift we have in common becomes this incredible metaphor for the way in which we congregate, we speak, we share, we celebrate our diversities.
One of the great locations this year is White Bay Power Station in Rozelle. It's very exciting for so many different people, whether or not you even think about how you engage with the art and cultural side of it. It's a building on our landscape that has been abandoned and empty for a very long time. Can you give us a bit of a kind of sneak peek, if you like, as to what's coming to that space?
It's incredible. And I kind of don't know how to answer why and how White Bay came about. Because as you're saying, it's this, anyone who's ever driven over Anzac Bridge has been like, what on earth is that building and why is no one in it? At very least, it's prime real estate for apartment blocks or something. But, you know, as a cultural institution, as this advanced space that, you know, it just blows the mind. It is now the venue taking over Cockatoo Island in such a unique, you know, industrial space, but also a space with a tumultuous history. It's, you know, a power station. It's that extraction of earth, of people. You know, my mind goes back to, well, pre-colonial, what would have that space been and how would have local people navigated and used that space, particularly being right by the water where it is, transformed into a space which now helps us ask those questions, or how artists utilize space and place to challenge ideas and or bring new ideas to us. So it's kind of an expansive space that you can get lost in. The infrastructure is still very much there. There's buttons and levers and lifts and all these incredible, I mean, it's like an artwork in its own right, just through its architecture. But then when you give artists the opportunity to engage with those spaces, some have been on site and actually working very specifically with space. Other artists' work has been made overseas and brought here and placed in the space. But it's really a very engaging opportunity for, you know, the public that I think, you know, I would encourage anyone to come to, whether you like art or not, just to, you know, immerse yourself within it.
I'd like to talk about your studio and where you work. We had Broadsheet visit in Brisbane a couple of years ago. Where are you based at the moment?
So I'm still in that house in Brisbane. I now live on the outskirts, off town, on a much larger property, due to many different situations, having children at the house, and family, being able to support them. And last time you were there, I was actually working out of my garage, which I've done for a very, very long time. But having this property has enabled me to look at the potential of building a studio, what that could be, what I want it to look like, which was finished mid last year, which also for me gives an opportunity for storage units as a collector to all come from Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne, the kind of bowerbird that I am. I've been able to bring everything I've owned together for the first time ever, which you know, has been incredible.
You talk about being a bowerbird. I wanted to get to this point where we talk about your long-held obsession, because you've been collecting objects since you were a child, and they really underpin a lot of what you do in your day to day. We're calling it Aboriginalia.
Yes.
Can you explain, perhaps, can you give us some examples of a couple of those objects?
Sure. Aboriginalia is simply kind of kitsch Australiana with images of Aboriginal people on it. Plates, cups, fabrics. Broad as I would always say, if it's been made, it's been made with an Aboriginal either person or image on it. And keeping in mind, this was an era of time where this was done without any consultation, any royalties, any opportunity to engage with actual Aboriginal people. So I always say that, you know, Aboriginal people were meant to be seen and not heard. We weren't involved in that. We didn't receive anything from that. However, these objects exist in abundance, and I've had a fascination with them since I was a child. So we literally grew up in secondhand shops. It's where everything in life was purchased, whether it was a necessity or then the non-necessity, my love for this imagery. Because for me as a child, it was images of people that I was surrounded by. And I often thought, wow, how do you get to be on a cup or a plate? Like, these must be really famous Aboriginal people. That really intrigued me. I did start to collect and had a little shelf in my bedroom where I'd put these objects. And amazing parents too, who just let me, you know, be a child and do what I do in the craziest way. I was a child that also ordered and displayed toys rather than play with them. I had a visual kind of iconography or way of doing things in maybe a slightly odd way, but that's where the collection started and where it grew. And then, yeah, it made a very transitional way from the home to the studio. And at that point in my life, as kind of late teens, early 20s, it was purely about storage. I couldn't actually have the amount of objects, because we're talking about tens of thousands of objects in my life, in my home anymore. So these objects being in the studio made a natural progression from the objects into my artwork itself. First using kind of iconography and stuff, then following through to that was using the objects themselves. So a lot of my work is built up installations utilizing this amassed collection.
You've got something coming up in Melbourne at the moment, which is photographic works depicting the Australiana series.
Yes,
so this is a series that really hones in on the ashtray that depicts images of Indigenous people.
Yeah.
And obviously that's a really hard thing to look at and think about, because these were made so that you could stub out
a cigarette
onto an ashtray. Can you describe one of those images for us? Because they are photographic works.
They are. And when I push works or think of conceptual ideas, it spans across different media. So it's very hard for me to pinpoint what I actually do as an artist, or say I'm a painter or I'm a photographer or I make video work. I do it all. But it's knowing and understanding what I want to convey in the work, and then picking the best possible outcome for that to, you know, have visibility in the world. And the ashtray was a really interesting one. My very first large-scale installation had some ashtrays in it, and I took them out, and then I put them back in, and then I took them out. There was something within the Aboriginalia that became very sinister within the idea of an ashtray. And as you said, the idea of what does it mean to put out a cigarette on someone's face, on someone's culture. And it became a very metaphorical idea of kind of the Aboriginal condition within Australia. The ashtrays became kind of this subset of the collection, which I always knew needed their own work, but took about, I think, another 10 years before I actually developed that and really looked very closely at those ashtrays. And the way in which I did present them was as large-scale photographs, literally the cameras floating above the ashtray, cigarettes burning inside it with stubbed out, and quite often we'll have a placemat or a fabric covering behind it. So you have this kind of indigenous iconography with then the Aboriginal ashtray placed upon it and then the cigarettes. But it's an expansive series of about, I think, close to 80 photographs, which goes to show how many or the abundance of these things. That everyone's a different ashtray. And I've subsequently made alternate series attached to it or paintings. But the vast growing nature of the ashtray collection has always fascinated me in just how abundant and how many of these ashtrays existed.
What period of time do you think those ashtrays were made or used?
In the kind of collectible history that I'm interested in, maybe, you know, 50s would have been kind of very early examples through, I mean, even now you can walk into kind of $2 or, you know, fake touristy, as I do my air quotes as well, shops and still obtain this kind of ephemera. But 50s to 80s, and then I think anything before that tends to lean into a different kind of collectible, because often, you know, a time when things were hand-painted and less mass-produced. So there's, even though they're part of the collection, there's something quite unique pre that. And then obviously now we're entering into Aboriginal enterprise, Aboriginal people having autonomy over these objects and making them, I don't think, ashtrays. However, the incredible market for clothing and homewares within a domestic setting that is done ethically, that is done with Aboriginal people, by Aboriginal people. So we're very much entering into a new, which I'm, you know, grateful for and a huge advocate and fan of as well, that kind of enterprise. But this middle part of our generational history, and I think something that many people around our age will know and understand or have seen within their home or their grandparents' home in terms of domestic objects relating to Indigenous presence within Australia.
It really does, for a viewer, place you in that domestic world, just looking through the lens. And as you say, photography is just one of the many different ways that you work with your art practice. I'd like to throw to something completely different. In 2021, you were commissioned to design the seating pattern of the new Allianz Stadium. Your design, which is called Two Worlds Colliding, Water and Land, is something people sit on at every game. What was it like working on something completely different of that scale and obviously outside of something that you would normally do?
Yes, it was absolutely insane and an incredible opportunity. And as an artist, when these opportunities come along, which are left of field, pardon the pun, but, you know, a seating design for a stadium, who would ever think, you know, that was in the realm of possibility? In the aftermath, though, when you look at that or you see photos of it minus the people, you know, there's methodology behind why hasn't this always happened? You know, design embedded into this literally like this almost pixelated idea of an expansive image. And then as people filter into it, this opportunity to engage further with space and place. I had the most incredible moment during the Women's World Cup where players were training and actually finding me on Instagram and writing messages to me about just how amazing to be on a field and to be encompassed by, you know, by this design.
And what it meant to them and their identity.
Yes, yeah. And to be in a place like Australia and be almost immersed within this Indigenous design. The design for me is very representative of the idea of what the playing field is. And between two worlds, from one side, you have this very cross-hatched geometric design representing the land of us as people, and the other side is this circle bubbling off the water, and it's literally like where the waves meet the shore and that crash. So my concept is, you know, for coming from the grandstand down to the players to the center of the field on one side, and matching that off the other, these two very different, you know, a circle and a geometric diamond colliding and meeting. So whether it's fierce camaraderie or absolute friendly game of any sport, it's these different worlds colliding and how beautiful that can be pending the way in which you want to look at it.
Two forceful energies.
Exactly.
Really beautifully put together. Are you obsessed with anything at the moment?
Given the opportunity with the studio and collating things, I'm kind of obsessed with just organization at the moment. And unpacking meticulously and to a point of procrastination. Like, I know I have to stop organizing, but putting salt and pepper shakers together after 20 years of collecting, postcards, spoons, erasers, jugs versus vases. So I'm like just being a bit too over the top with it. But there's something obsessive maybe with the collector within me that now wants to, with the opportunity to just display things, have that really perfect. Work has had to supersede at some point, but I do catch myself procrastinating and organizing things and go, no, Tony, you need to step back and actually do the work that really has to be done right now. Yeah.
What do you hope happens to these objects in the future?
The really interesting thing with these objects for me is that whilst they have no monetary value, they have a considerable cultural value. And only until recently, there is really been no even critical writing on it. I found research very, very hard in this area because it has been a part of society that is preferred to sweep under the rug than deal with, understand, and look at. And this is, we're talking about a whole generation of people which identified with Aboriginal Australian through these objects. So I would like to see them, even non-valuable objects, be collected within the realm of an institution or a collecting space, and documented. And, you know, it's just something that I've never done with the work, even when it reaches the large-scale installations. I've never actually documented each individual piece. And I feel in the aftermath that's something I wish I had done, because I look at my collection almost like a tidal wave. It comes in, but then it goes back out. So as a collector, I'm not necessarily like a hoarder collector. The collection actually has a tangible outcome, and it leaves me as well in a different way than when I received it. I feel it has a voice and it has its own autonomy when it leaves me, but I've never individually documented it. And I think that's something that needs to happen.
I would like to see that happen. I'd like to see potentially an entire floor dedicated to you in an institution. That would be great to see. You've said to us before that your work is optimistic. Do you feel that way?
It's a really tough question, but the undercurrent is always for me optimism in the face of adversity. That's what brings us to the life we live and exist. And when you don't have that there, it's so easy to give in. And we see it within our own people when that fire is put out and the detrimental effect it has on our health and who we are and how we live within a society. And I place no judgment on anyone who feels that way, because we probably should. We have a really horrible history here to deal with in this country. So having the opportunities I've had, knowing that I sit at the tables now that progressively are trying to make change, or at least be a voice at that table, I feel a real sense of importance that I'm someone who is able to make change from the inside out, and everyone has their own different skills. I admire the person who stands outside the building with a sign and protest. I absolutely agree with that as well. But where I can do my best work is from the inside, and it takes a really long time. I've gone into things and spaces and thought I'm going to change the world. But actually, after a few years, you realize I've just made this tiny little step. But I've learned to celebrate and appreciate those really small steps. And I'm very well aware of the incredible amount of time and effort and energy it takes in implementing change. So, you know, that's just my own philosophy and my own, you know, way of looking and living. But I have seen through that immense changes throughout my life. And so that element of optimism, I do, as small as it is, I want to hang on to, and I want to believe that, you know, we, for all of us in any capacity, that, you know, things can always get better.
It radiates your optimism.
I hope so.
And I think that people around you can take a tiny bit of it, or a little bit of that energy away as well. How do you celebrate success?
Sharing. Family and friends.
Are you someone who likes to sit down for a big meal or dine out or anything like that?
I love all that. You know, I always say, you know, a meal is never as good as the people you share it with. So for us people, particularly at home now, I've got the ability to cook underground and, you know, especially with the kids, you know, we cook kangaroo tail or something, engaging culture in a way that I wasn't able to do in the city. And I get great joy out of that. I get great sense of responsibility in rekindling cultural aspects of Aboriginal life that for such a long time either weren't accessible or literally frowned upon in doing. And, I see that within artwork as well. I feel my work has always had this political kind of connotations or attachment, or I've had to kind of push through the walls and doors of institutions. But there's this next generation of younger artists that are reclaiming culture, that are making shields and canoes. Or my cousin Erica, who's in the show, is, you know, making Jarwin baskets, this unique style of basket to the North Queensland rainforest. And I just feel that wasn't an opportunity for me. And in a small way outside of the art world, when I can reconnect with culture and have it as part of my life as an Aboriginal person, is very, very meaningful. And so it means a lot to me to, engage in those, you know, very small ways.
Thank you so much for sharing all these different elements of your life, from what you're eating and what your studio looks like to everything you're collecting. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you today. If you want to check out any of Tony Albert's shows, there are a lot of them right now, or a lot of places that you can interact with what Tony's doing. The Biennale of Sydney 10,000 Suns opens March 9th until June 10th. Photo 2024, The Future is Shaped by Those Who Can See It, Indigenous Futures, runs until the 23rd of March in Melbourne. And just a reminder, we're running a competition right now to win a $1,000 Broadsheet gift card. To enter, click the link in the show notes and enter the code word. Missed the code word? It's on the house, one word, all caps.